Acknowledgement of Country. I acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which we meet, work and study, the Awabakal people. I extend that acknowledgement to the land on which our listeners meet on. I pay my respect to elders past, present and emerging. Listener discretion is advised. The topics we discuss in this podcast may be confronting or disturbing to some. If today's episode causes you any distress, please contact Lifeline or the University's free counselling service. It should be noted that this podcast aims to educate and inform our listeners, and in no way does it support or promote the behaviours discussed. Welcome back to the Your Awen Crim podcast. I'm your host, Isabella Krebet, and in today's episode, I'm joined by BJ Jones of Fire Forensics via Zoom, and we're exploring fire investigation. Let's see what BJ has to say. How are you, BJ? Thank you so much for joining me.
I'm well, thank you. I'm in sunny Murundara at the moment, so interesting times.
So tell us about yourself. How did you become interested in this field and what are your qualifications?
So I'm a bit of a closet nerd. I started doing a BA in management and combined with laws. At University of Canberra way back when, and I was coming to the end of my arts degree and I was so bored looking down the year of tax law, which I needed a drink to get through, that I went, I think I need a career change before I even start. So I started looking around and decided that given I get bored quite easily, I really like the idea of forensic science because it was constantly changing. New advances coming on all the time, and I really like the criminal side of things. So I went to UTS and studied forensic chemistry with honours, and then did a master's. So at the end of my forensic chemistry, I got a job with the police, one of the first batch of civilian crime scene people. So I was a scene of crime officer there for 5 years, and that sort of covered me as I did my master's at forensic science. Which is all in the ignitable liquid analysis type area. And my honours as well was with the sniffer dog with the New South Wales Fire Brigade, one of the first few sniffer dogs that had come on that they were using for ignitable liquid detection at scenes. So once I sort of got into the field, and fire's always sort of been a bit of an area of interest for me, mainly because it's a bit more of a puzzle, a bit more interesting, it's a bit more... You have to be a bit more flexible in thought because you have to put everything back to pre-fire condition and then sort of just run through a lot of mental hypotheses of, if it started here, would I see that over that side of the room? Or if it started here, what would have caused it? And you also have to know a lot about a lot. So there's constant learning, which feeds my inner nerd. So you have to be like the ultimate generalist and bone up on the electrical wiring in a house, as well as appliances, as well as what's a fuel, how does anything burn, what are ventilation conditions, and then put it all together to sort of read what you're looking at post-fire to determine what happened. So I really like the sort of intellectual side of things, and also you do get fairly dirty and it's fun digging out, you know, burnt houses and wandering around and explosions, and then it takes you many, many places. So so that's sort of where I started. But in amongst all of that, I've sort of continued to study and done other degrees and bits and bobs. And yeah, so I moved from the police to the insurance industry for a couple of years, and then I went private. So I'm considered a fire investigator, but in the private sector now. And have a company called Fire Forensics, and that's what we do. We do the gamut of fire investigations across vehicles, residential, commercial, industrial properties, as well as heavy machinery fire. That's a specialisation of ours. And one of the things we don't do is bushfires, but we can look at those if needed, but generally if a bushfire goes through, there's not really a question about how a house burnt down. It's like that a bushfire went through. So we don't often get called to a lot of those in the private field.
BJ, that's incredible. You've had such an exciting career.
Yeah, it's more I've just sort of followed my nerdy interests, as it were. So, and that's worked out well for me.
Yeah,
so
that's awesome. So what percentage of fires are intentionally lit?
So for us in the private sector, we do the gamut, and generally we only see about 10% of deliberate fires in sort of the residential and vehicle space. A lot of what we do is recovery. So if a dishwasher's gone bung, the insurance company might sue the dishwasher people for the actual dishwasher having a failure, and they'll recover costs for the cost of the fire. So we do, deliberate is sort of actually a lot less than what you would think.
Why would a person deliberately start a fire?
So there are a few different reasons. Some of them are psychological. So your classic pyromaniac, which is actually a psychological condition, where you actually gain sort of sexual gratification release from setting fires, but that is like a minute percent. Most people would probably, you've probably heard about the people that set bushfires, and a lot of them want to be a hero, or they get a lot of stress relief actually from setting a fire. So it's not sexual, but it's sort of a stress relief. And then there's the covering up a crime. So people might try and, you know, steal a car and then burn it out so that there's no physical evidence for the police to actually charge them with theft. And then there's financial reasons, and that's where that sort of falls into a lot of what we do. People get stressed with finances and feel that they can't afford the repayments of their house or their car, so they actually try, or even business, so they, you know, set fire to the business. I think the Roselle fire in Sydney, which was the 7-Eleven, was one of those financial reasons where the owner basically was stressed and set fire, but you don't have any control when you set a fire, and it sort of killed a few people in the apartments above, which was really, really sad and horrible. So,
when you enter a crime scene, what's the first thing you look for?
So I'll just pull you back. It's not necessarily a crime scene for us. It's generally just a fire scene. It's to be determined if it's deliberate or not once we do the investigation. Sometimes it's determined as a crime scene by the fire brigade or the police prior to our attendance, but that isn't all of the jobs that we do. So in terms of what we do when we get there first, we generally do a perimeter search, and that's for things like glass that might have, if there's been an explosion or an overpressure, so a smoke explosion or something like that, the glass will have, from your windows, will have been thrown a distance away from the house. So we do a perimeter search, and we also look for ventilation and sort of smoke patterns outside windows to what's happened internally. We also check the structural integrity of the property for safety reasons, and then we check out usually the electrical service panel, because if there's been any electrical activity that's, you know, tripped a switch, a circuit breaker, or a fuse that's blown, or something like that, that indicates something might have happened to the wiring inside, we sort of check that out, and then we work our way inside, and we generally, once we get into the property, we as a general rule work from least to worst damage. So we go from the least area of damage inside the property to the most area of damage.
What are the patterns and phases of fire?
So in terms of the phases of fire, I'll separate that out into two parts. So the phases of fire, firstly, generally have an incipient stage, so you sort of set a small fire in a room. And then it, depending on ventilation, will either grow quickly or slowly, because it also needs fuel and ventilation. So if the fuel is there but the ventilation isn't, it'll be a very smoky fire, and it'll take a while to sort of build up until heat builds up and a window cracks or a door is opened, and then ventilation comes in and then it sort of flares up. So the incipient stage can take a few different mechanisms in that sense based on the fuel or ventilation. But once it's reached a point where the heat in the room, the radiant heat, so smoke and heat sort of rise to the roof, and then it radiates back down and it heats up all of the other furniture and items in the room. Once that reaches a point where those fuels, even the carpet on the ground, sort of starts to degrade due to the heat being applied to it, like the radiant heat, you end up with a transition phase called flashover. And that's where, in a nutshell, a fire in a room becomes a room on fire. So everything starts to burn, all right? So once that transition phase has been reached, you basically, it's really ventilation controlled. And once the ventilation conditions change, it can either sort of spread, break through the ceiling, break through walls, and then it's fully involved effectively within the room when the whole room is burning, and then it starts to spread. So a fully involved fire is one where everything's starting to burn and it's starting to spread. So those are the very general phases of a fire. In terms of the burn patterns, it does depend at what point in those phases the fire is put out, okay? So if a fire is put out in the incipient stage, you will end up with items that might be smoke affected and heat affected, but not showing specific fire or burning to them. Or there might be patches of burning within a room. So I'm just going to sort of confine it to a room so people can visualize it a bit easier. But once it reaches flashover and full involvement, where every surface burns, depends on how long that burning goes on as to how much overlay of the original burning in a room is sort of overlaid by the fully involved nature of the fire. So you really have to sort of look at what's happened in terms of the fire and what stage it's been put out to actually sort of then start thinking about burn patterns. That's in a very gross and general sense when it comes to things like an appliance having a fault or something like that. There are specific things we look at, but I'm not sure if you want me to go into that much detail. So I'll stop with the room, and those are sort of your general burn patterns in the room.
And how would you analyze burn patterns on a body or biomechanics?
So this is an area where we actually have a couple of specialists. Well, we have one specialist in-house who's training up one of our team members. And it is not my area, but I'll give you a general overview. So the biomechanics of someone standing up versus lying down in bed when a fire affects them are very different. So if someone's in bed and they're affected by smoke and they don't wake up, the burning will be sort of, they might have smoke in their lungs, but then they might have burning to sort of different parts of their body, all right, based on them lying down. If someone's sort of up and walking through the smoke layer, they might have sort of burning around their top part from the radiant heat coming down, and their legs and feet might have less burning, and then they'll fall over, and then if they're falling face forward, they might have burning on their back. So they're sort of reading it sort of in a similar way. In terms of if you think that someone's outside and they've set fire to a car, versus they've tried to put out a fire, it's where the burning is on their hands as to what they were supposed to be doing at the time and their body. And if someone's thrown petrol over a person and then burnt, like ignited it, there's something called like basically the vapor of the petrol ignites as a cloud. It's sort of like, I'll just say the only difference between a fire and an explosion is the speed. So within that gamut of like a fire being quite a slow process and an explosion being super, super fast, if you've got a vapor that sort of just ignites fast, it'll wash over you and it might singe your eyebrows and then do micro beading and damage to your clothing. So you might not look like you've been burnt, as I've been having some singed eyebrows. And this is someone who might have poured petrol over someone and then set them on fire, but your clothing might have flame wash on it. So that's sort of just a microscopic examination of the clothing. And basically the fibers in your clothing might show little beads and sort of microscopic melting on the surface. And that's a very fast phenomenon. So those are some of the things that are looked at within that area of burn patterns on bodies and people.
Wow, that's fascinating, BJ. How do you determine cause and origin of a fire?
So we start with the origin. And like I mentioned, we move from least to worst damage. And then we sort of try and get an area where we're interested and we think the fire might have started. And we can explain then the fire's moved from there elsewhere, and that explains most of the burning. And within that general area of origin, which could be as big as a room or as small as a, you know, a seat on a couch, we would then look for an ignition source, so something that's actually started the fire. And then from that, we then would try and tie how the ignition mechanism or ignition source is actually caused, come into contact with the fuel source. And then the mechanism is how that's then started to burn. So that can be as simple as a candle or a cigarette butt contacting curtain or a couch or a mattress. And so the contact is already there. But it could be as a little bit random as an appliance or a power board that's been shoved behind a couch and you've damaged the connections between your plug and your power board, and that's not been allowed to dissipate heat because it's been shoved behind a couch. And then that's actually caused heat buildup, degradation in the plastic, which is then sparked, caused arcing, and then that's actually then sort of contacted, like started the plug on fire, and then that spread to the couch. So there's a lot of things that go into it, but basically the two main points are what's your fuel, what's your ignition source, and then how did they come into contact. So that's sort of where we go.
How do you preserve a fire scene?
So preserving a fire scene can be quite tricky, given that it could be totally burnt out. It's generally keeping people out and securing the property as much as possible so that you can actually have that uninterrupted time frame from when the fire occurred to when someone is on site and examines it. When the police are involved or the fire brigade are involved, they're sort of on site immediately and they sort of put the crime scene up. When we get there, it can be days or weeks later, and we have to account for the fact that there might have been a second fire set from, you know, vandals in the area coming back in and setting another fire. There might be people that loot fire scenes and so forth, so we need to sort of consider all of that. But when it comes to evidence of things like ignitable liquid, if we think something's been bought, if we've dug out down to the floor level, so there's been a lot of debris on top, and then you take a sample from under the debris, that's less likely to have been disturbed by someone in the intervening time, if the property has been unsecured, than it would be if we were to just see something on an exposed area of carpet or so forth and just take that.
What is exhibit handling?
So exhibit handling, I'm sure you've heard of chain of custody. So exhibit handling effectively logs the exhibits you've collected and then can account for all of the intervening time between when you collected it, to sent it to be analysed, to looked at it in the lab, to stored it, and then if anyone needs to come back and examine it or look at those items in the future, that there's actually an unbroken chain of time that's accounted for with that exhibit. So that everything that happens with normal exhibits in terms of you know, fibres or crime scene exhibit handling is pretty much the same for ignitable liquid and fire scene exhibits.
How would you prove that it was arson?
So arson is a criminal term, all right? So it is a legal charge, charged with arson. There are three parts to an arson charge. You have to prove that someone has motive, that they have opportunity, and then the third one is that it is a deliberate fire. So that is the only area that as fire investigators, we engage in, all right? So our sole part in the arson charge is to determine if there is a deliberate fire. So that is the origin and cause has been identified as being related. It's not accidental. It is actually human action that's actually caused the fuel and the ignition source to come into contact and cause the fire. So that's where we come in.
What factors would lead you to identifying a potential suspect?
So when we look at a scene, not only do we look at the fire, but we would actually comment on the security, right? So if a window has been broken pre-fire, it's often a case of, like, when you look at a window that's been affected by fire, it might be smoke deposition on an inside, and then it fails, and the failure could be a result of a heat stress, all right? So it basically has a very different type of cracking to something that's mechanically damaged. So you might throw a rock through a window, right? So it's sort of like lazy cracking and heat cracking is very sort of long and curved and so forth, whereas mechanical damage might be very sharp and jagged edges and it's not got smoke on it, all right? Might be inside, like the jagged bits might be inside, so someone's broken it from the outside in. All right, and then climb through the window and set the fire. So security is often one of the issues we actually can comment on. And if it's something in terms of you think that someone who lives at the property or has access to the property and set the fire, were there any signs of break enter but the house was locked up before someone set a fire inside, indicates that someone with a key might have actually set the fire, versus, you know, an obvious sign of a forced entry that might indicate someone who doesn't have access to the property has actually set fire. So once we've sort of identified it as being deliberate, we also do look at the security.
What are the factors that indicate that the fire was an act of fraud?
So that then goes into what our clients look into, but if it might be an indication of fraud if they're financially stressed. So the insurance companies, quite frankly, have a lot of information on people, and they can request a lot of information in their investigations. So that includes financial records. So if someone is financially stressed, that's their decision. If someone's overinsured, so their car is worth $10,000 and it's actually insured for $20,000, or they have a claim where they've just taken the policy out, or they're coming up to the end of a policy, or they've changed the insurance value on the claim. These are all things that sort of highlight that if there's a fire within proximity, and those are sort of metrics that the insurance companies look at, but they're sort of flags, as it were. So that can sort of indicate a possible fraud, but it doesn't necessarily say that it was.
So battery science and technology is an interesting area within fire investigation. Can you tell us a little bit about that, please?
So battery technology is one of those hugely, I'm sure you've all heard about the lithium batteries and you know, battery technology is the way of the future. Well, all of your bits and bobs and anything technology related has a battery in it. And because the technology around it involves a lot of energy, when batteries fail or they're mishandled, so they might be damaged or so forth, they actually emit a lot of energy if they've got partial charge or full charge. So they actually can cause a lot of fires. And you do need to be aware that when something's on charge, like your power tool battery or your lithium polymer battery, which is something like for remote control cars, and they're sort of in pouches and so forth, you do actually need to be there to turn it on and turn it off because they can actually explode quite violently. And if you end up with a battery that's something like for a power tool, they're actually sort of little individual cells all in series, and then one might fail, and then because they're in series, they'll sequentially fail but get more violent as they get exposed to more heat. So the chain reaction actually gets quite violent towards the end of the number of like 9 or 10 batteries in series. So batteries are actually becoming quite a large problem, and given if you've got an internal defect in them, I think you've probably heard of the Samsung phone batteries that sort of all went off. That was sort of a design fault in the actual Samsung phone. But because, for example, millions of Samsung phones were produced at the same time, it's sort of economies of scale. So if you have a small fault, but you have a huge batch of batteries or appliances that have a fault in them, then you end up with a lot of fires. So the economies of scale make things quite scary if there's sort of an internal fault manufacturing, and that's where the recalls come in. So battery technology is kind of huge. Everyone's got them, so you should take care and just be aware a little bit. Once you get into this field, everything scares you. So you pull everything out and you never charge anything unless it's there, or you turn it off, you know, all that sort of stuff. So that's quite funny. So that's sort of where battery and technology is the direction of things are going at the moment. It's quite big.
Yeah, it sounds like a really progressive field and really interesting as well.
Yes.
So BJ, this podcast is sponsored by Espresso Warriors Katara. What is your go-to coffee order?
My go-to coffee order is a latte, quite a lot of lattes, just a general fat cow. I like full cream milk. So yes.
I'm sure you have to drink a lot of lattes throughout the week.
Yes. Keeps me going. So.
What do you do at Fire Forensics, BJ?
So I started out as an investigator, just learning my craft and so forth. And now I sort of train staff, I manage the business, I own the business, and basically I'm sort of growing the business for across the field. So, but my specialties are a little bit of battery tech and also heavy machinery. So I'm currently in Moranbah after attending a mine for a big truck bar. So we look at big machinery that are like three stories tall and crazy big pieces of machinery. So currently I'm effectively managing director of Fire Forensics.
Wow, that's amazing, BJ. My dad works in the coal mines. He's a mechanic on the trucks. So yeah, it's terrifying just having him work on them. I can't imagine what it's like when they explode.
Yes, there's usually a lot of people, and I usually ask a lot of questions.
Yeah.
And, so we know fire, and we then apply that to pretty much everything that we see.
What's a typical day at Fire Forensics like?
So it can be as small as going to someone's kitchen fire, which is, you know, confined to, you know, the stovetop and just the area around it, to looking at a burnt out vehicle, to going to a chicken shop that caught fire, to travelling out west, like travelling all over, because, you know, we don't sit in the office, we have to attend the scene, as it were, like you can't actually do this remotely. Coming to Queensland to look at machinery fires, I've gone over to Africa on 4 days' notice to do machinery fires over in mines over in Africa. So it's like we've sent people to PNG and Philippines, and we do the gamut. We do a lot of legal reviews, so we'll do work for legal aid all over Australia, and do comments for different big mining regulators and investigations on those fronts. So the gamut is very, very wide, and yeah, it's crazy.
No day is ever the same by the sound of it.
No day is very much ever the same, and no fire is the same, which is great.
So fire investigation requires individuals from multiple disciplines, as you've talked about. What disciplinary backgrounds are of the people that you work with?
So we've generally taken people with a forensic science or a science degree, because one of the things that we really highlight with fire forensics is that we follow the scientific method. Okay, so any science degree will sort of teach you that, and because it's such a niche field, we cross train. So it doesn't really matter what your science field is, it's generally applicable, and you just have to do on-the-job training. So we have about a, you know, probably an 8 to 12 month training process in-house, where you literally just ride along with the senior investigator to actually get your skills up, see the gamut of fires, because it's sort of like you can't really understand what you're seeing until you sort of see the range from the small kitchen fire to the massive industrial, and then sort of work backwards. So So we take people who have mechanical interests and electrical engineering interests and fire protection interests and chemical interests, and mishmash all of that together, and basically cross-train you in fire, so that you overlay what your current learning is with fire investigation.
Can you provide an example of a case that you've worked on?
Okay, so I'll go back to one of the mine fires, because I like mine fires, in Africa. And I've never done a job where it was not a deliberate fire, but there was basically people stealing fuel. So they were in Africa. Fuel is at $2 a litre, right? So it's quite expensive. And the average salary for a month for a person working on the mine, which was quite a good job, was $600 a month, all right? You have a fuel tank on an excavator, which is three stories tall, and it's a big diggy thing, big donker truck, and it has 8,000 litres of fuel on it, all right? So that's $16,000 US. And there was like just a shift that, one dodgy shift that just would steal fuel. So they'd drain the fuel tank. and, you know, break the machine in the process and then actually cause fires across the machine. So they lost like three excavators, and these are like $15 to $20 million a piece of equipment. It takes a year to get one sent in parts from like Japan and the places that actually manufacture them, and then they have to put them together like from all the bits on site. So, you know, you lose the machine and it takes you like 18 months to actually get back to the operational standard that you had before. So they were quite interesting, and it was so that one, like, they literally took the breather out and their fuel cap off the top because they'd broken. They have like almost like airplane refueling systems, like they have like a thick nozzle at the base of the unit and they plug it on and it full refuels the tank super fast. All right, so just like a refueling of an airplane. But they broke that and they couldn't work that out. So they, because they kept changing these things to sort of keep ahead of the thieves. So they went up to the top and they removed both the breather and the fuel cap. So I turn up the top and then there's like the fuel cap is off. And then you turn it over and it's literally got fuel written on it. So you can still see that the name of the cap is fuel, but it's melted in situ. And then they've been siphoning it off into like 20 litre jerry cans on the top deck, and then they've had a spill and it's gone over the back engine and then blown across, and the engines work super hot, so they can get like 600 degrees like across an engine bank, so sort of vapors come across and blown out the engine and set fire to the machine, and it was, I've never seen anything like it. It was like crazy, and this was not the first one they had this problem with. It was like, right, okay, this is a thing. So and then you learn that refueling tank people would get a job at the mine and then work up to becoming a refueling tanker. So they would just drive around in the truck with the diesel on the back, and people would just drive off into the bush, and then they'd find the empty tanker days later with a note in the front seat going, oh, thank you so much, I'm really sorry, but, you know, I needed to feed my family, so I've just nicked the fuel and here's your truck back. So it was like craziness, Africa. It's like insane. So yeah, eye-opening.
Wow, that would have been an exciting opportunity though.
Oh, it was, but I generally sort of work alone and with sort of one fitter or something like that to sort of walk me through what's going on with the machine. And on this instance, they turned around and said, right, we've hired you for the mine. So I was hired by the mine and the maintenance people to work out what had happened. But then there were investigators for the fire protection system that was aftermarket and put on the machine. And then there was investigators from the insurance company. And then there was like a cast of thousands and they said, be team leader. And I'm like, well, that's outside my skill set, but all right, I'll give it a crack. So it was a bit crazy.
How incredible. Fire investigation is still developing. What would you like to see of it in the future?
So we're very sort of practical fire investigation, but it does need a lot more scientific research because even now fire modelling is not ideal. There are a lot of parameters and assumptions that go into a fire modelling, and it's not something that is easy to sort of plug into a computer and work out. So we need a lot of background scientific knowledge about what happens when you change a structure's ventilation from one room with one door and one window to two windows. How does that change a fire setting, you know, one corner versus another, or a fuel package changes in the room? So there's a lot of basic science that needs to be done, and we need sort of keen beans to sort of get out and do that stuff.
What would you recommend to anyone who's interested in this area?
Okay, so there's a lot of online learning that you can actually do for free through the International Association of Fire Investigation. There's a CFI Trainer Net, so they have a certified fire investigator training program, so CFITrainerNet.com. And so you can sort of do a lot of online learning there, just little modules that sort of test your interest and so forth. Get your skills up in your preferred area, and then there's different programs around. Charles Sturt University does a graduate certificate in fire investigation, which is very sort of structural and actually sort of the academic side. So you could do something like that. You can reach out to, you can do it in crime scene within the New South Wales Police as part, but it's a subset of the crime scene field. You could join the fire brigade, and then unfortunately you had to sort of be, I think, station officer rank to sort of get into their fire investigation unit. So that requires that you sort of work as a fire investigator and then get to that point. And then in the private sector, there are sort of a lot of one-man bands, so you could probably reach out to one or two of the big companies like us, or there are a few other companies around. There's only a few, like two or three in Australia. And maybe see about what's going on with them. And there's also a lot of one-man bands, so people specialise in just the electrical engineering side or the mechanical engineering, so they do a lot of just machinery and truck fires and so forth. So there are a few different ways, but unfortunately, you sort of, it depends a lot on relationships. So there's the Association of Fire Investigators, there's the New South Wales branch, there's the Queensland branch, there's the Victorian branch, and the New Zealand branch. Get in touch with them and start reaching out, making contacts and seeing what's going on, if it's your field.
Amazing. Thank you so much, BJ. Is there anything that you'd like to add?
No, it's a crazy little field, but it's very, very rewarding when you get into it. So, yeah, I love it.
You've been listening to the UON Crim podcast, run by the University of Newcastle's Criminology and Criminal Justice Society, hosted by Isabella Krebbett. A special thank you to this week's guest, BJ Jones, Corey DiPasquale for composing the podcast theme music, and Tamika Hillebrand for her administrative assistance and support. I'm your host, Isabella Krebbett, and I'll be back with another episode in 2 weeks. In the meantime, you can like the UON CCJS on Facebook and Instagram.